In the waters of Prince William Sound off Valdez, Alaska, the Exxon company is attempting to clean up the mess made by one of its tankers, which hit a reef Friday night and ruptured. The accident occurred after the tanker had taken on a full load of crude oil in Valdez at the terminus of the Trans-Alaska pipeline. It's estimated that as many as 11 million gallons of crude oil spilled, creating an oil slick encompassing 50 square miles. State officials from Governor Steve Cooper on down are far from satisfied with the way Exxon has conducted the cleanup. Governor Cooper says the state may take control of the operation.
The oil industry was convinced that this kind of thing would never happen, and they did not put an adequate response mechanism in place. That's certainly the way it appears to me at this time.
Mm-hmm. Weren't they supposed to, though, Governor, under the agreement in which they were allowed to construct the pipeline and the port at Valdez, they made certain promises to fishermen and to the state that they would take care of cleanup?
Well, certainly, and more than that, they were required to have a contingency plan in case a major spill of this sort took place. They may have had a contingency plan, but if they did, it didn't work. At the moment, the state is considering requesting the regional response team, and that's a team of federal and state authorities, to ask the Coast Guard to take over this cleanup. We, the state, are going to take some action here, even though it's legally a little suspect. We don't care. We're going to do it anyway. And if anybody wants to file suit, I guess we'll worry about that later.
Governor, the area where the tanker ran aground has been described as an incredibly rich ecosystem, full of wildlife and an important fishing area. Any sense yet as to the effect of this spill on that area?
Well, we've seen some killer whales in the oil. We don't expect them to survive. We've seen sea otters in the oil. They won't survive. That's a certainty. And there are a lot of birds, a lot of ducks in it. We and the Coast Guard have been trying to retrieve those ducks as we see them. But the spill is enormous. The last I checked, it was about 9 miles by 4 miles, so it's a massive area. There's no way of avoiding damage to the wildlife. It's already been done, no matter what we do from here on out. There's going to be damage to the wildlife. We hope that it's minimal in the sense that the wildlife can recover over time.
How can the oil companies be held accountable for what's happened in Prince William Sound?
Well, they'll be held accountable in a fiscal sense, but the money doesn't take the place of the damage in terms of restoring the area to what it was previously. It's going to take years and years to do that. And in my opinion, money is not equivalent to the damage that took place. They'll be legally responsible. In fact, Exxon came in and admitted that they were responsible for the spill, which indeed was pretty clear to anybody that knew anything about it. But, I mean, they didn't blame it on an act of God or anything. But nevertheless, I mean, the legal wrangling can go on for years and years in the courts, and the deck's always stacked, by and large, in favor of the people who've got the most money to hire the most capable lawyers. And if I were a fisherman and I lost a year's income in Prince William Sound because of this incident, I would be pretty bitter.
Alaska Governor Steve Cooper spoke with us from the State House in Juneau.
Philip McCrudden is general manager of the Glacier Kelp Group. His company catches herring and harvests kelp in Prince William Sound. McCrudden says he's apprehensive about the effects the oil spill will have on Alaska's fisheries industry and its habitat.
Right now, we're just assessing whether we're going to be able to conduct a fishery. The fish haven't entered the area yet. We probably are about a week away from seeing the fish, and what the condition of the spill will be then, it's hard to predict. At this time, it's pretty tentative as to whether we're going to be able to conduct the fishery this spring.
Do you think there'll be any long-term damage?
Well, clearly there's going to be some habitat damage from the amount of oil that's involved here, where it gets moved around and distributed, depending on what kind of habitat it gets in. Clearly, there will be long-term damage. We're just trying to set up some kind of a program that we can start to monitor this.
Even if the herring escape the oil, is it possible, as some fishermen are saying, that your business will be hurt because of the publicity about the spill?
Well, it's difficult to say. Our markets are sensitive to quality. You know, part of the product that we sell is the fact that it comes from very, very clean water. And I think this whole business with the apples and the fruit recently indicates that people are sensitive to those things. It's certainly not going to help matters any. And, you know, I don't want to make negative conjecture on what it might or might not do. We're going to try and do everything we can do to ensure, and the state of Alaska will, that no product leaves this state that isn't perfectly free of any contamination.
To whom do you sell much of your catch?
Almost all of our production goes straight to Japanese buyers.
And will they be particularly troubled by this? Will they be less likely to buy from you?
It's difficult to speculate. I think that they want to be assured that there's no quality problems or contamination, as would any buyer. And I think at this point in time, they're willing to work with us. But, you know, we're going to have to wait and see how much larger this bill becomes before we reach the point that it's not reasonable to expect buyers to come in and purchase product from this area.
Do the Japanese and any of your other customers have enough other sources that they can just say, well, forget about them for a while until they get their act together. We can just buy from someone else.
Well, about 50% of the production of our raw and kelp products coast-wise is produced in British Columbia and 50% of it here in Alaska. It would clearly create a market shortage if there was no production here. But on the other hand, it's also a very high-priced product, and I'm not sure at what point the buyers would want to risk paying that kind of money for something that might, by the time it got to market in Japan, not be marketable. So, you know, we're really, you know, at this point, we're very concerned.
Governor Cooper says he's fed up with the cleanup effort. What do you think about it? How's it going?
Well, as much as I'm concerned about the spill, I have to be sympathetic with what a tremendous task it is. I think that there was not the kind of readiness that you would expect at the major saltwater terminal in the world, in the United States anyway. And as up until now, we're really dissatisfied with the amount of equipment that's been, you know, put into cleaning the spill up.
Who's to blame for this?
Well, I mean, the initial error on the part of the pilot seems to be pretty clear that the ship shouldn't have been where it was. You know, I suppose in a longer-term view, you know, probably when we built the pipeline, we might have looked at exercising the option of having it go through Canada and be an overland pipeline rather than routing it through the Sound here, but that's kind of hindsight. At this point in time, clearly the tanker was in error when it was operating.
Well, this was one of the fears when the pipeline went in, wasn't it?
Well, it's true, and, you know, many people in the environmental community and the fishing community said that it wasn't appropriate to have a saltwater port because the risks were there that eventually there would be a spill, and I think that in the original plans, it was clear that the probability was in the 20-year life of the shipping program there would be a spill. However, built into that was the assumption that we were going to have a world-class oil recovery team here in Valdez and the equipment to carry it out with. And unfortunately, that isn't the case. We're still waiting to fly in equipment from England. We're trying to bring in booms from other parts of the United States. Right now, we're short on simple things like absorbent material.
A spokeswoman for United Fishermen of Alaska says fishermen aren't ready to absorb any loss and expect full compensation. That's so with you?
I don't think that anyone can say how the procedure of, you know, paying fishermen back for any losses that they might incur will happen. But I think that we have a concern that not only short-term income losses be reimbursed if those come to pass, but that long-term reimbursement on trying to restore and mitigate the habitat is included in any kind of ongoing program.
Philip McCrudden is general manager of the Glacier Kelp Group, which fishes the waters of Prince William Sound. He spoke with us from Valdez, Alaska.
Seven years ago in Alaska, on a trip to Valdez and Prince William Sound, I asked Matt Kenny, then the Coast Guard quartermaster at Port Valdez, to describe the worst-case scenario at the southern terminus of the Alaska pipeline.
The worst scenario would be a fully laden tanker going aground in the Narrows and splitting its hull open and letting oil out.
This past Friday, that happened. More than 10 million gallons of oil spewed out of the Exxon Valdez after the tanker struck at least one rock in Prince William Sound. Questions now include why an unauthorized pilot was in control of the ship at the time of the accident, why equipment to clean up the spill was not in place, and whether the worst spill in American history can now be cleaned up. Our reports begin with Steve Heimel of Alaska Public Radio in Valdez.
The tanker was apparently pushed by winds gusting as high as 70 miles an hour. And according to Exxon Shipping President Jack Iarossi, simply pivoted around.
During the worst of the high wind gusts, the vessel pivoted approximately 12 degrees to the north. I understand from the people on board that that was not a very pleasant feeling as the vessel was pivoting. But their feeling this morning is that the new position feels much more stable than the original aspect we had immediately following the grounding.
Iarossi says he's not concerned about the vessel breaking up, and he views the weather as a temporary setback in a cleanup effort ready to go.
I am disappointed that some things are not moving as fast as we would like, but in spite of all that, I am just elated to see progress. I am so happy to be moving forward rather than standing on that goal line. I expect that we will get many more disappointments and upsets. There's no way we could eliminate them. The important thing is to be ready to respond quickly when the circumstances change.
The company has tried corralling the oil and burning it, spraying chemical dispersants and skimming it up. Iarossi says all methods have worked, but the volume of the spill is so enormous, nothing is going to keep it off the beaches. State and local officials have been highly critical of the slowness of the oil industry to respond to the spill, and were not comforted by news that the tanker is shifting. Fishermen are already talking in terms of the damage to their livelihoods. Some fishermen say their customers are already telling them they're not going to be interested in Prince William Sound fish this year. And they say as much as $100 million income could be at stake this year alone. Processor Ray Cesarini of Seahawk Seafoods in Valdez says bottom fish, herring, crab, and salmon could be unsellable even if they're not damaged by the oil.
We were looking at the possibility of a 40 million fish catch, which was actually half of the entire pink salmon catch for the state of Alaska. And we may not be able to sell it.
The fishermen say their questions about how the spill could have happened are still not being answered. Answers became a lot more unavailable today when Exxon decided to stop commenting on the events leading up to the spill because it's under investigation by the National Transportation Safety Board. But the investigators say they intend to hold public hearings on the incident within a few weeks. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Heimel in Valdez, Alaska.
Kelly Quirk is coordinator of the Ocean Ecology Campaign for Greenpeace. He joins us from San Francisco right now. Mr. Quirk, how common have oil spills like this been in Alaska?
Well, this year they have been beyond common. They've been chronic. This is the 13th spill in Alaska this year. This is certainly the largest one. It's the third in Valdez.
Given that these things have happened so often, how is it that people in Alaska don't have the equipment handy or the tools handy to contain a big oil spill?
Evidently, a lot of the equipment which would ordinarily be in southern Alaska was down in Seattle. It was being fitted onto a barge which will accompany a drill ship which will be going up to the Chukchi Sea, which is the ocean north of the Bering Sea in northwestern Alaska, later on this summer to drill for oil there.
It's sort of like, on an enormous and tragic scale, I lent the vacuum cleaner to my neighbor, so it's not around in time.
Exactly, and the point is that even if it were around, studies have shown that I think a very generous estimate is that they're able to clean up about 5% of an oil spill in the most enviable, that is the most calm of conditions. Historically,
you have described the technology for containing and for cleaning up an oil spill as prehistoric. Why? What does it do, or what doesn't it do?
Well, the thinking basically is that they would contain the oil spill either with booms, put some floats around it, and the oil will be trapped there, and they'll try to skim it off the water, or even worse, what is used are chemical dispersants, which are harmful, in some cases toxic to marine organisms, and what they do is they break up the oil into smaller droplets, which slowly sink to the ocean floor. And while they sink to the ocean floor, they fill the water column, affecting any marine animals, and then they can smother any bottom-dwelling organisms.
But we do hear accounts of what sound like far more sophisticated ways of dealing with spills, using lasers to, in effect, burn off the oil on the surface.
I've heard of these accounts as well. I am not entirely familiar with them. I'm not aware that at this point they're that sophisticated. With the panic that we've seen up in Valdez in the last couple of days, I think we can be assured that if this sort of technology is available, it wasn't available then to use, or at least to be able to make any significant difference in the way that the spill has spread.
When you speak of panic, what do you mean exactly?
The reports that I get was that there was no clear chain of command as to who had jurisdiction, who was going to be in charge of the spill. There were a lot of people running around like chickens with their head cut off, evidently. And all the while, oil was leaking out of the Exxon Valdez at the rate of 20,000 gallons an hour, and continued to for at least 14 hours before there was any attempt to clean it up at all.
You've described a virtual epidemic of oil spills recently, and up in Alaska, a great many of them. I was looking, though, at a table of the rankings of size of oil spills, and it was pretty clear that the biggest spills seemed to take place 10 years ago, late 1970s, some of them in the 60s. Is anything getting better here at all?
Well, industry argues that their technology has improved in terms of being able to prevent oil spills, but the fact is that just in this year already, in addition to the 13 spills we've seen in Alaska, a platform blew up in the Gulf of Mexico a week ago Sunday. There was the spill in the Olympic Peninsula. There have been two in Antarctica this year, and there was a spill off of Oahu in Hawaii. They are guaranteed to continue, as I said, because of Interior's and the oil industry's plans to drill offshore essentially the entire coastline of the country. And I might add, industry uses an argument that their technology in terms of preventing blowouts, as we saw in Santa Barbara, for instance, back in 1969, has greatly improved. But the fact is that earlier this year, Texaco was fined $750,000, and a supervisor was fired and was given a suspended sentence and a $20,000 fine because they falsified the test. So it seems to me that it's hard to put faith in the technology when we're being lied to by industry.
Kelly Quirk, a coordinator of the Ocean Ecology Campaign for Greenpeace, spoke to us from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco.
E.J. Cheshire lives north of Valdez in Alaska. He makes his living fishing the waters at Prince William Sound. He first heard of the spill early last Friday morning.
First news I heard, woke up to my alarm clock radio and heard that the tanker had gone on the rocks and Valdez arm shot straight up out of bed.
Did you go out on the boat to see what happened?
No, I have my own airplane and I went out and viewed it.
Well, tell me what it looked like on Friday.
On Friday, it hadn't spread too far yet compared to what I thought it would be. They give me a figure of 10 million gallons on the radio and on the news, and I expected it to be spread farther than it was. It was, as it was on Friday, about 2 in the afternoon when I went out, it looked like about 5 to 6 mile stretch, and 2 to 3 miles wide.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen it today from the air?
I saw it yesterday at 12 noon, flew to Anchorage and viewed it on the way, and it spread. Looked like it was covering about 100 square mile area that it was spread out into.
Does it make you angry to look down there and see the tanker run aground and the oil spreading out like that?
You can't believe how it makes me feel. It's serious business. Everyone in this town that has anything to do with, well, anybody that lives there is really afraid of what's going to happen. You know, we're afraid for the next 10 or 20 years here of what this is going to do to our whole biological system in the Sound here.
Well, how could it affect things 10 years away?
Well, I have no idea, and I don't think anyone here does. We're just afraid of what could be the ramifications. There's a lot of oil out there, and it's going to go somewhere.
Yeah. As a fisherman, with the season coming up, what's the first thing you're going to look for?
that concerns me is the smolt out-migration from all the streams and hatcheries that will be coming out here within the next month. The salmon smolt, and that's the small stage of salmon, and that will affect our 2 to 4 year cycle here, depending on the type of salmon. And that's the kind of long-term stuff we're worried about. As far as immediate season on salmon, I think that it might not have nearly as much effect as the upcoming year after and up to 4 years here. And then that's just one fishery. We have herring fishery coming up here. I fly spotting herring for the purse seine fleet here in the herring purse seine fishery. And we don't even know if we'll get a fish that, and comprises about a third of my income for the year, and a lot of others also.
E.J. Cheshire of Cordova, Alaska.
Joining us now from Valdez is Al Kegler, a field officer with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. He's leading a spill cleanup team today along the beaches of islands in the Prince William Sound. When one thinks of someone trying to clean up an oil spill, one wonders about the mechanics of this thing. How exactly do you go about it?
Usually in something like this, you have large gathering devices called oil spill containment booms that you can deploy in the water, and it'll concentrate the oil inside the boom, and you have mechanical skimmers then that will skim the oil off the surface of the water, pump it into a tank or a bladder, whatever you have, that kind of thing. When you fail that in the open water and the oil washes ashore, you have really no option then other than going ashore and cleaning it up manually by hand.
Can you explain how your cleanup effort differs from the cleanup being conducted by Exxon?
It's different in that it's a more labor-intensive cleanup rather than a mechanical cleanup. So where on the one case you're dealing with large machinery that when it breaks down, it's near impossible to repair in this location. The thing that we're hopefully relying on is just people and simple tools.
You're going out today. Explain to us exactly what you'll be doing.
We'll go into a number of areas that have been identified as being extremely environmentally sensitive, critical habitat areas, and we'll try a number of methods to entrap the oil and pick it up with sorbents. We'll also attempt to deflect oil with booms from other sensitive areas that have not been hit yet, and that type of thing.
What are the most important areas to hit first?
Of course, the fisheries areas are very important. The salmon streams, the shellfish beds, critical wildlife habitat, waterfowl, that type of thing.
How does this compare with other spills?
This one's unique for certainly the state in that it is the largest volume of oil we've ever dealt with, and certainly is in one of the most environmentally sensitive areas in the state.
And that makes it more difficult?
Much, much bigger job. Many more places to try to protect in the first place, and then certainly when it's all over, many more areas to go back and clean up.
So it's more than just the sheer volume of the spill.
Right, right. And the logistics are certainly extremely hard. It's not like cleaning something up in your backyard. The distances are involved are hundreds of miles, and you have to work off boats and aircraft, helicopters, that type of thing.
How long do you anticipate the cleanup will take?
I would imagine it would certainly be months, and the assessment work would also entail that amount of time. I would imagine we'd be well into summer before. It's pretty hard for me to say at this time.
Is the spill expanding? Is it moving out to sea? Is it coming into shore? What exactly is happening?
At this point, it's moving through a very complex series of islands that form the inner Prince William Sound, and it is migrating out to sea.
What does it look like, anyway? What would I see if I were to come up then?
Oh, you'd see slicks that are measured in miles, many slicks that are 2 and 3 miles wide and 4, 5, 6 miles long.
And it's washing up on shore. You've seen the environmental damage already?
We're beginning to see it just now. It really first touched land and will continue to come to land for at least weeks to come.
Well, thank you very much. Al Kegler is a field officer with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. He'll be leading cleanup teams along the beaches of Prince William Sound. He spoke to us from Valdez.
Some conservationists are wondering now whether they fought hard enough for a long pipeline all the way through Canada when the Alaska pipeline was being considered by Congress back in the late 1960s. Rupert Cutler was Assistant Executive Director of the Wilderness Society when the issue was first discussed.
When oil was discovered at Prudhoe Bay, the chairman of the Senate Energy Committee, Scoop Jackson, called us all over to his office and said, "Well, gentlemen from the environmental community, I know you're concerned about this, but we need the oil. We're going to get the oil out. We'll try to do it in an environmentally sensitive way." And then they proposed a Trans-Alaska pipeline system. And we said at the time, please, if you're going to build a pipeline, build it overland to the Midwest, because the last thing we need is an oil tanker accident at the Port of Valdez.
Let's go back just a bit to Prudhoe Bay itself. Ice in the wintertime, so you can't get in there with ships. So you were giving in right away to the idea of a pipeline that would come down through Alaska.
Wildlife refuge at that time, it was to the west of the refuge, and so it was state land, and there wasn't much we could do legally about oil development at Prudhoe Bay. So that was probably going to go forward. The question was, where would the pipeline go?
The oil companies wanted it to come down the pipeline to Port Valdez and then to go down to California on tankers, the oil. And you wanted it to go down through Canada how far?
To the Midwest.
To the Midwest, Minneapolis, Chicago.
Right, that's where the refineries could have been, and it would have been closer to the heartland and to markets for the material. Our bottom line is it's a lot easier to pick up the oil from land than it is from water.
Yeah, but surely it was far more expensive than it could warrant to bring it down by pipeline all the way to the United States.
I don't recall that it was seen as that different a cost, but there was this attitude on the part of the U.S. that we want to make it an all-U.S. system. There might have been also an intention to sell the oil to Japan, too, which would have been much easier to do from Valdez, although that's ruled out by current law.
Now, had you thought over the years that perhaps you were wrong in opposing the port at Valdez and the transport of oil by tanker out of there?
Not for a minute. We expected this kind of accident sooner or later with the rocks and the reefs, the fog, the icebergs. And now, of course, it appears that there was negligence involved with the skipper being down below and an unqualified third mate at the helm.
Isn't the lesson here, though, simply to have better pilots on these tankers?
Obviously, it's too late now to change the route of the pipeline. We're stuck with that, and we'll just have to do a much better job of policing and regulating the tankers and making sure that the harbor pilots perhaps stay on longer than apparently was the case. But the cleanup will never get to a problem that'll be there for decades, particularly if they use that chemical dispersant on it. When the first effect of this dispersant, of course, since it's toxic, will be to kill the herring and the young salmon. But then it will drive the oil to the bottom where it will lay, and it will kill Dungeness crab and king crab and shrimp, and it will sit there in globules, and they'll rise to the surface over the years and repollute year after year. It'll wash up on the beaches. probably put the herring and salmon fishermen out of business for several years. The migration of the Pacific flyway ducks and geese and shorebirds from their wintering grounds in California and Oregon and Mexico to Alaska to breed has just begun. The waterfowl, the ducks and geese are just coming in. If they get this oil on them, they're done for too. So the wildlife damage has yet to be seen. And of course, if the tanker splits open, if they can't get that oil offloaded successfully, then the eco-catastrophe will be even larger.
Rupert Cutler is now president of the Defenders of Wildlife in Washington, D.C.
Exxon tanker in Alaska. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator William Riley and Transportation Secretary Samuel Skinner saw the spreading slick from the air last night. The oil now is flowing from Prince William Sound into the Gulf of Alaska. Federal and state officials and Exxon executives acknowledged yesterday that there's little they can do to prevent the oil from contaminating important fishing inlets. From Valdez, NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports that fishermen will take up the battle against the oil.
Helicopters and pontoon planes were flying in and out of Valdez all day long yesterday, taking one group of researchers after another to see just how bad the damage is. The way Steve Zimmerman of the National Marine Fisheries Service described it, the oil has formed a 55-mile-long slick, and as it moves south through Prince William Sound, it's clogging dozens of miles of craggy coast along some of the most beautiful islands.
Boy, you know, you look out there right now. Have you been flown over the area at all? You look at some of those islands that were downstream and intercepted that oil, and there's just huge quantities of it pooled in there. You look on down on that and you say, my God, that's going to affect that area for a long time. And I was told some of the people went ashore yesterday, they found it 20 feet up into the trees because you get a lot of wave action and it breaks out like whitecaps and it kind of sprays up into the trees even.
The official line here, at least Exxon's official line, is that they're going to clean the oil off all these islands. And Exxon's top executive in Alaska, Don Cornett, reconfirmed that when a reporter pressed him at a press conference just last night.
Is it your intention to clean up all the oil that lands on beaches in Prince William Sound?
It is.
But one of the federal government's top cleanup officials here, David Kennedy of the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, says there's no way that anyone can clean up most of that oil. The shores of these islands are incredibly convoluted. They're carved up into tiny coves. Many of the beaches are covered with piles of egg-sized rocks, which trap the gooey oil. And Kennedy says to clean those beaches, you'd have to literally dig up the beaches and find some place to throw the gunk. But since the islands are so remote, he says, there aren't any roads, how will you send in the equipment?
If you had barges and I can't even think of the name of these types of vessels that have a front that drops down on them, but
like in the war movies, the Marines,
right.
Land.
These are what they're called, LSTs. You might be able to get equipment in that way, but in terms of normal accessibility, in other words, able to drive on a road to the area, get your equipment off, drive it to the beach, pick up the beach, put it in a dump trucks and drive it to someplace, that's absolutely out in all the areas.
Kennedy says they'll have to let nature take its course and wash the oil away. He says they expect that might happen over the next 2 to 4 years. In the meantime, Kennedy says, the only realistic thing people can do now is to try to keep those millions of gallons of oil from oozing into four crucial inlets. There are fish hatcheries in three of the inlets and a fish breeding ground in the fourth. And officials coordinating the cleanup from the Coast Guard, Exxon, and the State Environmental Conservation Department have all agreed that those inlets are the most sensitive spots in the path of the spill. At a press conference yesterday, officials announced that the area's fishermen, not Exxon or the Coast Guard, will be protecting those fledgling fish,
Fishermen living on Prince William Sound will stretch huge floating barriers called booms at the entrance to those inlets and hope the oil slick bounces off them and back toward open sea. The fishermen, of course, have been charging all week that Exxon bungled the cleanup job. They've been demanding to know why, along with state and federal officials. Exxon waited almost 3 days after the spill to try to do much about it. Jack Lamb, the leader of a local fishing industry association, described at a press conference how he and his fishing colleagues came up with a strategy.
They wanted to know, what can you do to help us additionally? That was at approximately 8 o'clock last evening. We made a call to Cordova, where we've had vessels standing by. At 9 o'clock, we received a fax back with a list of 15 vessels that would be ready to go, and at 10 o'clock last night, the first one was underway.
Sounds to me like you're not waiting for Exxon to take in charge of this anymore, that you guys have seized command of this yourselves and to protect your own interests. Is that correct?
I'm not going to project what happened in the past. It doesn't help the present, and it certainly isn't going to help the future. From this point forward, we are all working together to save our industry.
Late last night, though, fishermen reported they were having trouble flying the booms all the way from Valdez to those remote inlets. And as of early this morning, they were just starting to try to put the booms into place. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Valdez, Alaska.
The captain of the ill-fated oil tanker, the Exxon Valdez, apparently had been drinking around the time of the accident and oil spill last Friday. That, according to a spokesman for the National Transportation Safety Board, which is investigating the accident. The spokesman reported today that a Coast Guard officer who boarded the tanker just after it struck the reef said the captain smelled of alcohol, but appeared alert and capable. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling is in Valdez, Alaska, and is on the line. Danny, explain to me, we thought earlier that a third mate had been at the wheel, not the captain. Of what significance is it that the captain was found with alcohol in his breath?
Well, the third mate, who was actually driving the tanker, apparently was not qualified to drive the tanker in these somewhat treacherous waters where they ended up hitting the reef and breaking open. So the speculation is, if the captain was drunk, the reason the third mate, who wasn't certified, was at the wheel was to cover for the captain who was drunk. But this is still all speculation.
Now, what progress is the National Transportation Safety Board making in its probe?
Well, not a lot of progress, which is why this is all still speculation. At a press conference today, William Woody of the National Transportation Safety Board said that the captain and the third mate are refusing to talk about the accident. Their lawyers, you know, have told them to hush up. So the board is postponing hearings on the accident. There are a few other little curious details, though. It turns out the investigators didn't do an alcohol test until 9 hours after the accident, and even though there was an alcohol test right on board the tanker. And what is it today, almost 6 days after this accident, they still don't know the alcohol test results. They said they might know Friday, but they aren't sure they'll tell us, the public, even if they get them. So goes the investigation.
Now, what about the cleanup of the oil? How's that going?
Exxon had a press conference right afterwards. It seems here, Robert, that reporters are spending most of their time not out looking at the spill, but in press conferences. They said it's going great, but when reporters pressed them for details on the cleanup, it didn't look so great. Out of 240,000 barrels spilled, they say they've picked up a total of 5 or 6,000 barrels, and then they acknowledge that miles of shoreline are black with thick, foul, oily gunk. You know, I have to confess, I was not at the press conferences today. I went to see if I could dig up a copy of the fabled contingency plan. The fabled contingency plan is what everybody's been quoting all week, but nobody apparently has actually read here. This is the plan, the blueprint, that spells out exactly who is supposed to do what in case of an oil disaster.
Now, what does it say?
Well, you know, it's a classic case where you have hundreds and hundreds of pages that sound impressive, but when you read the fine print, it makes it clear that the oil industry doesn't really know exactly how they're going to cope with a disaster. They say at the beginning, the resources of Alyeska Pipeline Company are organized in a pre-planned manner to ensure rapid and effective response to any emergency in accordance with state-of-the-art oil spill cleanup technology. I'm quoting there, Robert.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to that, they go on in incredible detail with all sorts of maps and charts to show exactly which fish will be in which critical stage of their life cycle and which inlet, and therefore exactly how many feet of oil barriers people must erect immediately in order to protect the most sensitive parts of Prince William Sound. Sounds great.
Yes, it does sound great, and as it happened, the weather was perfect. So what exactly was supposed to happen after the spill?
Because when it comes down to the most crucial part of this plan, who's going to rush to Prince William Sound? What equipment will they have, and how long will it take them to get there? There's no real details in the contingency plan. There's only one paragraph in this entire two fat volumes in which Alyeska says, look, we believe that it is highly unlikely a spill of this magnitude would occur, and therefore, it would require such huge logistical operations and resources, we can't spell out the details here. All they say is, we are going to call boat companies, plane companies, private contractors all around Alaska, and we will request them, that's the word, request them to send help as fast as possible. No details, though, of are the people going to come? Have they agreed to come? How long will it take to get there? Just, we will request help, and between the lines, I guess they're saying, we hope they'll show up. People have been blaming Alyeska and Exxon for the failure of the cleanup job, but I think this suggests that the government is at fault, too, for approving a plan that doesn't spell out the most basic details of how are things going to be cleaned up.
NPR's correspondent Daniel Zwerdling in Valdez, Alaska.
In much of Prince William Sound, the damage has already been done. Oil has surrounded some islands. In some places, high winds are reported to have whipped the oil into a froth and carried it up into the trees. But in other areas, the oil slick is still miles away. There's still time to block or deflect the spill. Rand Little is the production manager of Prince William Sound's Aquaculture Corporation's three man-made salmon hatcheries. And together they produce an estimated $50 million worth of fish every year. Rand Little today has been trying to get the boats and the equipment in place to save those hatcheries.
It's been a long, continuous stream here. The days kind of blend together. This morning, well before dawn, we were still trying to mobilize oil spill protection equipment for Port San Juan. It's been trickling in there at a rate slower than we would have liked, but we do have the majority of the equipment there now with more equipment on the way.
What are you trying to protect?
Port San Juan houses the Armin F. Koenig hatchery, which is a very large salmon hatchery, produces 6 million adult salmon for the commercial fishery every year.
Has the oil begun to get into the hatchery?
No, it has not yet.
How far away is the oil now?
12 to 15 miles away is the nearest oil.
Now, we're hearing stories here about the herring roe season is approaching, that the herring are laying eggs on kelp in Prince William Sound. Do you know how that is going, if that industry has been threatened?
That is probably the most threatened industry at this time.
Now, you say you think you can reduce the impact on the salmon fishery that's coming up. What are you going to do?
Our primary concern is protecting the fish which are out migrating into saltwater pens now and which will be released into the nearshore areas between the middle of April and the middle of June. We're going to do our best to deflect oil away from our facilities in the nearshore rearing habitat and do whatever we can to clean up the areas that are fouled prior to the release of those fish.
You're able to get the booms pretty much into place. Do you think you'll be successful?
The physical situation of our hatcheries and what the physical oceanographers tell us is that with deflection booms and absorbent booms, we have a good chance of deflecting or blocking a majority of the oil. We presently have monitoring equipment headed out to each of the hatcheries to monitor the concentrations of hydrocarbons and toxic materials in the waters.
Would the fish, though, assuming that they are hatched and get to swimming size, don't they have to swim out then into the oil in Prince William Sound?
That's correct. They will be leaving the facilities between the middle of April and the middle of June. We do have some advice that suggests that by that time, the major effects that might impact those young juvenile salmon will have passed in the area that they'll be swimming and feeding.
How do the people you're working with, how are they responding to this? I've read there are 6,000 people working in fishing in Prince William Sound. Wouldn't that mean really that 6,000 people are pretty upset that there's oil in the water?
There's no mistake that people are upset and concerned about it, but I think rather than focus on the negative aspects, they're trying to do the best they can to relieve the situation and make it better. And there's a great deal of community effort and industry effort. From our efforts, we've currently spent well over $100,000 in materials and transportation. We'll spend considerably more than that in trying to protect ourselves and also right now at Port San Juan, there are approximately 5 seine fishing vessels helping deploy the boom to protect the hatchery.
Rand Little, production manager at Prince William Sound Aquaculture. He talked with us from Cordova, Alaska.
The soul of a presidency can be first revealed in the way it responds to an unanticipated emergency.
News analyst Daniel Shore.
For George Bush, the Texas oil man in the White House, the test may be the Alaska oil spill. His reflex was to defer blame and penalties and focus on the dire need for environmental protection and cleanup. Finding that no one was effectively in charge, he suggested that the federal government may have to take over control. The federal government? Isn't that idea anathema to a free enterprise Republican, heir to Ronald Reagan, who vowed to get government off our backs? Well, theoretically. But Bush's roots are more in management than in ideology. And what managers do is, well, manage things in times of trouble. President Reagan might have made a television speech comforting and reassuring the nation. Bush, less charismatic, more pragmatic, sent a team to Alaska to tell him what was wrong and whether it was time for the federal government to take over. On the environment, President Bush has promises to keep. Also on education, children, crime, drugs. He's apparently discovering that not all these can be delegated to 1,000 points of light. He is hearing that a federal role may be necessary in the policing of this murder-plagued capital city. He has alluded to the possible need for new gun control legislation. But the Alaska oil spill must be a special kind of hell for this lover of the great outdoors who has always believed that environment could coexist with energy extraction and that great oil companies could be trusted to maintain the balance. So now the nation faces a crisis big enough to challenge a big government. And Bush seems to have few qualms about deploying these resources. Someday, a learned commentary may be written about the comeback of central government under the stress of emergency. For now, the word from the Bush White House seems to be, let's get moving. This is Daniel Shore.
Since the spill occurred last Friday, one question has been asked over and over. Why wasn't Alyeska, the oil company consortium that owns the Alaska pipeline, better prepared to control the spill? When construction of the Alaska pipeline began in the early 1970s, the oil companies and the government agreed on a contingency plan, a supposedly fail-safe procedure for cleaning up major tanker spills. But as it turned out this week, it took the Exxon company almost 3 days to begin its cleanup of the spill in earnest. And by then, it was too late to contain the spill. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling, who is in Valdez, has obtained a copy of the contingency plan. He says that the fine print suggests the plan would never work.
Before we get to what's wrong with the plan, try to picture Valdez and what this place is all about. The Prince William Sound is a spectacular maze of mountains and fjords and coves. And it's not just a tourist attraction. The sound shelters some of the most valuable fish hatcheries in the world. Now, smack in the middle of all this sits the end of the Alaska pipeline, the Valdez Oil Terminal. This terminal ships 1/4 of all the oil produced in the United States. Huge tankers are constantly moving in and out of these straits and fjords, maneuvering around rocky islands. It's very tricky, potentially dangerous stuff. So, to put the nation at ease, the oil companies had to spell out exactly how they were going to prevent an oil spill disaster in a blueprint called the Oil Spill Contingency Plan. And for the last 12 years now, every time politicians or researchers or environmental activists worry about all these oil tankers up here, the oil companies remind everybody, don't worry, we have the Oil Contingency Plan, remember? But if you carefully read this contingency plan, you'll see it fills hundreds of pages with reassuring language that never quite answers the crucial questions. And those questions are, when a big spill happens, exactly who's going to clean it up? What machinery will they use? And how are they going to get it there in a hurry? The beginning of the report is optimistic.
The resources of Alyeska Pipeline Company are organized in a pre-planned manner to ensure rapid and effective response to any emergency with state-of-the-art oil spill cleanup technology.
And the report has page after page of management flowcharts. to show who will give orders to whom, how the Alyeska oil spill coordinator will give commands to the Valdez terminal director, who gives commands to the marine operations director, and how key commanders will be on call 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and the contingency plan predicts where an oil spill might happen.
It is theorized that the two most probable areas in Prince William Sound that would be subject to oil spills are the Valdez Arm and Hinchinbrook entrance.
And sure enough, that's where last week's spill actually happened, right around that Valdez Arm. And then the report goes on to describe in detail which 136 coves and inlets and bays are most likely to be affected, and what kinds of fish will be at what stage of their life cycle during which month of the year in every one of those spots. The report even spells out where the oil companies will immediately deploy special barriers called booms to protect these sensitive spots from the oil.
Vlaskov Creek is a salmon spawning stream on the north shore of Jack Bay. Deploy about 1,500 feet of boom across the mouth of the creek from the small peninsula on the south shore to the north shore to prevent oil from affecting the delta
above
mid-tide level.
Anyway, the government asked the Alyeska oil companies to spell out how they would accomplish all this and who would do the work if the day came when a tanker spilled 200,000 barrels of oil. As it happens, the spill last week was around 240,000 barrels of oil. And the contingency plan lists all the pieces of equipment the oil companies are going to keep on hand in Valdez to rush to the site of an oil spill.
Three tugs, one contingency barge, three slickskin manta ray skimmers, four Vacumax vacuum devices, 150 blankets, 50 pair of
rubber
boots.
But now we get to the fine print. If you look at a small chart near the end of the report and add up a bunch of numbers, and by the way, the report doesn't summarize the information for you in plain English. You have to do your own adding. It turns out that under the best conditions, the emergency equipment on hand at the Valdez terminal could clean up only 15% of a 200,000-barrel oil spill, which leaves a rather big question. Who is going to clean up the rest? The oil company's answer.
The minute details are not included in this scenario.
That's the answer. No details. In one paragraph, the oil companies say they'll request citizens who own private boats to assist them. They'll ask oil spill specialists around the state if they can help out. The oil companies will request airplane charter companies to help fly in supplies. In other words, when the big spill happens, according to the contingency plan, oil company managers will get on the phone and urge people to come help them. Top state officials told me it shouldn't surprise anyone that the oil companies couldn't control last week's oil spill. They say anyone who'd read the contingency plan could have predicted that. But they say you can't blame just the oil companies for coming up with this plan. After all, these officials say the state government, which gets more than 80% of its state revenue from the oil industry, approved it. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Valdez, Alaska.
Exxon officials have conceded that wind and tide and waves have carried the Alaskan oil spill beyond any control. It appears that very little of the 10 million gallons of crude that gushed into Prince William Sound can be recovered. The extent of the environmental damage cannot be calculated yet. Some important areas may be saved, but many others are already inundated with oil.
There were several important developments today. A test taken 9 hours after the Exxon Valdez ran aground showed the captain to be legally drunk. And the Bush administration decided to leave Exxon officials in charge of the cleanup operation, at least for the time being. We'll hear details in a few minutes. But first to Valdez and NPR's Danny Zwerdling, who spent most of this day flying over the spill in a State Department of Environmental Conservation plane.
I wish you could hear the sound effects of the single-engine plane that we took off from the tiny Valdez airport. There's only one runway, and we took straight toward the side of a huge snow-covered mountain. A little frightening. Then suddenly we banked sharply to the right, crossed an amazing range of jagged mountains, and then headed over Prince William Sound, over rugged, rocky islands covered with pine forests, past glaciers. We headed first toward one of the fish hatcheries that everybody's been most worried about, one of the biggest salmon hatcheries in the world in Maine Bay. Over the last couple of days, Noah, fishermen have madly been erecting a floating barrier. It looks sort of like a big red string across the mouth of the bay.
At this point, the wind's out of the west-northwest, blowing the oil away from the bay, so it's looking good. Well, there's always a chance of currents and winds changing, and that's what we're afraid of. If we get something out of the southeast, it'll blow it back toward the bay.
Danny, I take it from that tape that in some parts of the Sound, at least where you were today, there was no oil at all.
Yeah, it's really rather remarkable. The oil has been moving pretty fast. It moved 35 miles in one night, and the environmental investigators we were flying with told us that just yesterday they'd seen huge, long swaths of oil in some of the areas that looked quite pristine to us today. The oil has been moving south. But when we started catching up with the oil farther south, boy, we really caught up with it. I mean, you see these massive, miles-long slicks of oil that look like giant oil puddles in a wet parking lot.
Look at this oil here, all black, heavy.
Right now we're flying over a little, almost like a lagoon, an open lagoon, that looks like a tar pit from a couple of hundred feet up. The water is very, very still, very thick looking. There are huge black, purple, oily puddles on it, and for what looks like at least 10 or 15 feet up the shoreline, which is generally a sort of sloping, rocky, pebbly shoreline, is thick black with gooey-looking oil.
When the oil gets back up into those coves like that, especially the smaller ones that have a fairly steep elevation, at the head of the cove, you'd have to get some pretty good winds to push that oil back out again. There's undoubtedly some of it could get out, but it's less likely to at this point.
One thing that I never realized in all the talking I've done with people, all the looking at maps, I never realized until we actually flew out here what an enormous area this is and how vast the oil slick has become.
Yeah, the first couple days I flew out here, it was almost incomprehensible how much area is covered.
Danny, that sounds really bad in some parts of the Sound there. What about the wildlife, the birds, the sea lions? Did you happen to see any dead creatures on the water?
No. And in fact, very few oily animals have been seen at all. And this raises a rather crucial point. It's a sort of hard-headed scientific point that marine researchers say it's hard for a lot of people to understand. And that is, yes, the spill looks bad. I mean, it's heartbreaking to see it. But just because a huge spill is fouling miles of beautiful coast does not necessarily mean that it's going to cause serious, long-lasting environmental damage. And the reason, as marine researchers told me, is that the weather and the wind and the currents, almost everything nature's been doing in the last few days has been perfect to minimize the damage. Now, this is a crucial time of year right now in the lives of fish. Over the next few weeks, herring will be laying eggs in kelp beds along the island's shores, and little salmon are going to be swimming out of the island streams into the Sound. But they're going to stay close to the shore, and government marine researchers say the winds have been pushing the oil just past those crucial areas, sort of like in a chute past them, but away from shore.
I've been doing this about 13 years. I've been to well over 100 major oil spills. That, in my own mind, the one thing that I can say is that oil spills generally don't turn out to be nearly as bad as they seem when they first happen. This happens to be a very pristine area. We know there's going to be some damage, but what I've seen typically, almost in every case, is that the area recovers, and it recovers much more quickly than people normally would expect.
Of course, the thing is, Noah, the weather is mercurial here, and literally overnight, the situation could shift.
Thanks. NPR's Danny Zwerling talking with us from Valdez, Alaska. The three senior officials that President George Bush sent to Alaska reported back today. They say the cleanup is now proceeding at full speed. The report was not all negative, the president said today, but let's be frank, there are some very serious problems up there right now. We have details from NPR's Jim Angle at the White House.
The administration has made the tentative judgment that after a slow start, Exxon is now doing everything it can to contain and clean up the worst oil spill in U.S. history. And Secretary of Transportation Samuel Skinner said that means there is no need for the federal government to take control of the cleanup efforts, as many critics in Alaska, including the state's Governor Steve Cooper, initially demanded.
He believes that the effort is now going forward at the correct pace, that Exxon, the state, and the federal government are working well together, and that at this point there is not a need to federalize this effort.
In fact, said Skinner, because of the coordination now underway, imposing federal control might be counterproductive. Skinner also said that although Exxon took 3 days to get organized on the cleanup, he is not sure a more rapid response would have made much difference because most of the oil spilled almost immediately.
Approximately 10 million gallons went into the water, and most of that went into the water in the first 5 hours. That is not to say that had the response team reacted quicker and gotten on scene and been more effective sooner, we couldn't have contained some of that.
Skinner said the first priority now is to do everything possible to protect the environment. It is too early, he said, to talk about civil or criminal penalties against the crew of the tanker or against Exxon. But Admiral Paul Yost, the commandant of the Coast Guard, which will carry out the investigation, made clear that the ship's crew will have a lot of explaining to do. He said it is almost unbelievable that they hit that reef.
This was not a treacherous area, as you people in the press have called it. It is not treacherous in the area they went aground. It's 10 miles wide. Your children could drive a tanker up through it.
Asked if he wasn't letting Exxon off easy in his remarks about the cleanup, Secretary Skinner said what is important at the moment is that Exxon has admitted that it's a horrible mistake and disaster, and that the company has committed itself to spending millions and millions of dollars to make the environment whole and to compensate business losses.
Exxon has made a commitment that they are going to basically put their money where their mouth is and have made a commitment in people and in dollars to deal with this problem.
Skinner said he is willing to take those assurances at face value, but that the federal government would also hold the company to that pledge. Some of the damage may be difficult to repair, and officials aren't yet sure how extensive the environmental problems will be. Environmental Protection Agency Chief William Riley said this is obviously a disaster of enormous potential magnitude.
It seems inevitable that there will be very substantial impacts, particularly on habitat of the sea otters and the sea lions, and that the damage may be felt there for some time to come.
Riley said this bill has not prompted the administration to reconsider its views about development of resources in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. He said the nation has energy choices and that all of them entail some risks and some costs. We need Alaskan oil, he said, and he argued that if we turn to imported oil, we would have the same risks from tankers of foreign oil coming into other environmentally sensitive areas. I'm Jim Angle at the White House.